Welcome to another packed edition of the Radio Today programme. This time we're talking digital radio as we hit the magic 50% in the UK. Plus Trevor Dan reports from the British Podcast Awards, and I've been catching up with BBC Radio Manchester late night host Alan Bezick a year on this week from the Manchester Arena terror attack. James Cridland will delve into the data to see what it can tell us about superfans. And in David Lloyd's Radio Moments, memories of Mercia, Plymouth Sound, Laser 558, Mayo at breakfast, and Fern Cotton's departure from Radio 1.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
Yes, a really frank interview coming up with Alan Bezick, who was on air in Manchester the night of the Arena bomb last year. Keep listening for that. First, though, as always, Radio Today's editor Roy Martin is here to talk about the week's news, and the OC has gone.
He's gone. His wife, his kids, and probably his dog by now have all probably touched down in Australia, ready for his new show. I think it's the 4th of June, isn't it? He starts on Gold FM.
Gold 104.3, yeah, not long to go now. And like most people, you were probably listening to the last show on Friday last week.
I heard the last show. I was listening to it. I thought they were actually in tears. A big emotional moment for them both, for Richie and OC.
It's been an incredible ride, and I can't thank you enough. And this was, it would always be my dream. And thank you for making my dream come true. And Jesus will help. I'm not going to say bye. I'm going to say chanks for everything you've done for the show. Radio is one-on-one. I know we often talk about there's loads of you listening right now, and I'm aware, I know what the figures are. There are a lot of you listening right now. We just found out we've broken the online listening again for the fifth time. But this show's memory, I know how it works, right? Radio is ephemeral, and I've always known that. This show's memory will fade, and I understand that. You shouldn't feel bad about that, but it will not fade in my heart.
There we are. The last word he said on UK radio was heart.
Maybe the first word he says on UK radio as well in the future. Who knows? Well,
first word he'll say on Australian radio might be gold. So there we are. Global, the big winners. So talking of global, big winners in Radar this week, really.
Radio, yes, it came round once again. It seems to get quicker every single quarter. But, our headline was Heart is Bigger Than Radio 1. Now, a lot of people think Global were spinning this, but Global didn't even realise that the Heart brand had more listeners, adult listeners, than Radio 1. I had to point it out to them and said, yep, that's a good one. I'm going with it. To the backlash of many. But I thought it was good. And of course, in London, they're dominating with Capital, Heart and LBC getting the top three commercial stations in terms of hours and share. And KISS coming in second place if we're looking at reach. So Capital really still dominating in London.
And on the Heart brand, we probably must just point out that that does include Heart 80s and Heart Extra, whereas the Radio 1 figure doesn't include One Extra. So if you added that on, then Radio 1 probably would be above them, but there we are.
Yeah, but Radio 1 and One Extra, completely separate service. Heart and Heart Extra, it's pretty much the same, isn't it?
Well, let's bring in Ford Ennals, the Chief Executive of Digital Radio UK. It's been a great week for digital radio. The Radars were out, and the magic 50% has been hit. A few drinks to celebrate this week, I guess, Ford.
Hello, Stuart. I mean, it's been a good week. I think it's been a good week for digital radio, but it's been a good week for radio. I mean, I think what the 50%, and it was 50.9% digital listening this week, signifies is just how far radio has come. I mean, it's overnight success, 20 years in the making. It has taken a long time to get to this point. But I think we really ought to be marking it, and I think celebrating the fact that radio is keeping pace with the digital age. And I think the fact that over 50% of listening is now digital is good for radio, it's good for listeners, and it makes sure that our sector is increasingly future fit to compete with all the online music streaming services and everything the internet's going to throw at us.
And some stations had made the 50% already, and obviously they're flying now and into the 60%. So that tells us on average, if we're just hitting 50%, that there are still some still a little bit under, and there's more work to be done. So how do we do that and get them up to 50%?
Now, Stuart, you make a very good point. There is more work to be done. We are only at 50.9%, so we've got 49.1% to go. We are committed, and I think the broadcasters are committed to completing this transition to digital, because we think it's the right thing for the radio industry. And as you say, it's not an even spread. National stations tend to have more digital listening than local stations. If I looked at all the national stations on average, their digital share is 60%. So our focus now has to be on looking at local stations and local areas and trying to get those up to the to above the 50% level as well.
And how do we do that? Is that more transmitters? Is that more SSDAB multiplexes? Or what are the ways we're going to actually get that pushed to the next stage?
Well, you know, I do think that the local digital listening number is growing, but it has been growing faster than the national level. It's just come from a much lower base. It took a long time to get all of the, for instance, the BBC local stations onto DAB. We only, you know, launched another 14 or 15 multiplexes in the last few years to get all of the BBC stations on, and some local stations are quite late to DAB, and they are growing strongly. I do think that there probably is some work to be done in terms of assessing local coverage and looking at DAB coverage on the road network. So I think that's a piece of work that still needs to be done.
Yeah, cars, I suppose, still, as always, has been one of the big challenges for you over the last few years. Those people who haven't bought a new car with DAB, or as I've been hearing from some friends this week, people, you know, going to buy a second-hand car that's only maybe a year or two old and being told, well, we don't have one with DAB already in it because nobody wanted it at the time. So that's still a big challenge with some of the manufacturers and with older cars, isn't it?
Absolutely right. I mean, we've had this conversation before. I mean, great progress has been made. I mean, 90% of all new cars going on the road today have DAB in a standard, which is, I think, has been game-changing. And a lot of people like you who have a car with DAB in them are very, very satisfied with that. But as you say, what that does mean is that there's, you know, the majority of cars, probably almost 70% of cars on the road don't have DAB. So it takes a long time if you're relying on new cars to make that transition. So we need to continue to work with the vehicle industry to get from 90% to 100, but equally to make it much easier and frankly more affordable for people to convert their existing cars.
In terms of online listening, obviously the digital 50% figure includes not just DAB, it's online, it's via digital TV and that kind of stuff as well. How important is online listening? I know a lot of the conferences recently, the focus has been on Alexa devices and all about voice. Looking at figures from the BBC just this week, I know it's iPlayer TV stats, but 11.9 million gigabits of data transferred on Saturday alone by the BBC iPlayer. I was staggered by that. There's a massive, massive use of online at the moment, and how important is that, that the infrastructure is there for all stations to up their online listening?
Well, look, I think it's really important, and obviously we're seeing it grow, and this time round it grew faster than any other digital platform. I think the annual rate of growth was about 17% for online listening, and it went to a new high of about 9.3%. And, you know, I do think over the next two or three years that could double to 20%. If you look at how younger audiences listen, there's much more online listening. And obviously we think the voice speakers, the proliferation of voice speakers and smart speakers in people's homes is also opening up more online listening. So it's absolutely critical that the radio industry is harnessing this and is ready to take advantage. But I think those investments largely have been made. I know the BBC are revising their iPlayer offer this year, and I know we've seen the global iPlayer. Obviously we've seen upgrades to radio player. So I think the radio industry is in good position on this. What I would say, though, is that 72% of digital listening is still on DAB. And we can't imagine a time, whether it be 10 or 20 years away, where we don't have a digital broadcast platform at the heart of digital listening. So I think what we'll continue to see is IP, DAB growing along side by side.
You're in regular contact with people in government and people at the heads of the BBC and the radio groups as their kind of industry representative on digital stuff. What does the industry want to do, and where is government on that in terms of regulatory change or making some kind of formal plan now for switchover?
Well, as you know, Stuart, I mean, the government, when they set up a digital action plan a few years ago, they established very clear criteria for having a review on digital radio. One of those was building out the local DAB coverage, building out the national DAB coverage to FM equivalents. But the other was getting to 50% digital listening. And we're at that point now. So what this will do will trigger a government review, which we'll see probably later this year. And I think it'll be a time for government to talk to all parts of the industry, not just the broadcasters, but the supply chain, the retailers, the manufacturers, the car guys as well, and determine whether it's the right time to set a timetable for digital switchover, or whether we need to actually put in place another further program of work to make more progress. So we will see that review this year, and obviously all broadcasters on all sides of this debate will have the opportunity to input to it.
Do you really think it'll happen this year? Obviously, a lot of policy's been kicked into the long grass because of Brexit and all the time in Parliament, and that might be taken up over the coming months. Does the government have this as a priority? Have you had a kind of assurance from DCMS that they do value it as an important thing to push on with?
What DCMS have said to us is that, you know, they've made a commitment to have a review, to have a consultation process. So I'm fully imagining that dialogue and that debate to happen. I'm not sure the exact time frame of it, and I don't know when it will come to a decision point, but I do think it's a good point, and it's a healthy thing for the industry to do, because I do think that we would benefit from having greater clarity about the way we move forward. If you talk to the broadcasters, and I know there's been some controversy about this, but if you talk to the BBC, if you talk to Bauer, if you talk to Global, they're fully committed to a digital transition, and ultimately they don't want to be in a place where they've got, you know, they're broadcasting on all these different platforms. They've got dual transmission on analog and DAB. What they will say, though, is that they're cautious, and they don't want to make any premature decisions. They want to make sure that they do this in a way that they're taking the listener with us. So I think the process of any formal transition is some years away, but I do think we'll be seeing a review and a debate about that this year.
Okay, thank you, Ford, for talking to us, and keep listening to Chris Country. I know you're personally responsible for its audience figure reach this quarter. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm a massive Chris Country fan. So good work out there, Chris. But there are other digital stations available, and I recommend you listen to them.
The digital only stuff is doing all right, actually, isn't it? Heart 80s and stations like that, and Six Music, just absolutely flying still.
No, I mean, I think if you, one of the things I would say, if you've been in the radio industry for the last 5 or 10 years, I mean, 10 years ago, the broadcasting groups were a bit sceptical and a bit slow in some ways to bring new stations onto DAB. But now they've found that they can very quickly get an audience. I mean, you talked about Heart 80s. We've seen it grow three quarters in a row now. It's almost 1.5 million listeners, and it seems to have happened overnight. So if you look at Sound Digital and Digital One, their capacity is pretty much full, and all of those stations are flying. So it's a really, really healthy picture, I think.
Well, that was for Endles. Roy Martin is still with us looking at the week's news. We've got some news of new awards for under 18s. The Young Arias were launched this week at the Tuning In Conference. So this is a thing between the Radio Academy and Radio Centre, and it looks very interesting. It's aimed at 8 to 18 year olds at school radio stations and hospital radio and local projects and things like that. They're going to be opening the entries later this year. And Roy, what have you got there? Radio 2 going to Ibiza.
This is a headline that you look at and think, what? Radio 1.5. But if you think about it, at Radio 2 in Ibiza, everybody who listened to Radio 1 20, 25 years ago when it happened on Radio 1, they're probably on Radio 2 by now. So to relive it and to celebrate the dance music of the 80s and the 90s, it probably makes a lot of sense, and I'm sure it'll be a good weekend.
Okay, thank you, Roy. Off on holidays next week, so you won't be with us.
Hurrah!
Hurrah for the listeners, yes. Stay tuned. Coming up, a really interesting interview with Alan Bezic, who was on air the night of the Manchester Arena Bomb. First, though, Trevor Dan has been to the second annual British Podcast Awards.
Thank you, Stu. This was a slightly more formal evening than last year's inaugural event. Everyone at King's Place in London had a seat, and there was a conventional stage, but it lost none of its intimacy. intimacy and its atmosphere of celebration and mutual support for the medium. It was a competition, of course, but there was a palpable sense of collaboration too. Afterwards, people were swapping ideas as well as phone numbers, asking for tips and comparing how much or how little they spend and earn. It was nice to see celebrity presenters happily chatting to bedroom podcasters. And as an event, it was refreshingly free from the corporate interests and rivalries which can affect radio awards dues. Well, you can see a full list of the winners on the British Podcast Awards site. And in a minute, we'll meet Cariad Lloyd, who won three prizes for her wonderful Griefcast. But before that, Observer Radio critic Miranda Sawyer, one of the organisers of the event, Matt Hill, and our onstage host, Ollie Mann, in a very noisy after-show party.
It's noisy here, Ollie Mann, but you can tell me what you've learnt from tonight. You were a great host, by the way.
Thank you, thank you. Am I on the Radio Today programme now?
You are on it!
Fucking love the Radio Today programme. What did I learn? I learned that doing difficult subjects in your podcast is no block to winning awards. I mean, Griefcast, what a great show. Completely deserved. And really nice to see... You know, I think the great thing, we're only in our second year, obviously, but I think the great thing about this awards, and it's true of all UK radio award ceremonies, but it just seems particularly true of this one, is that people really are rewarding, the judges really are rewarding the shows they think are the best. And in podcasts, that does mean you have a really personal connection with them. And that's amazing because, you know, there are some very big names. I mean, Fern Cotton alluded to this herself on stage, who weren't nominated.
Well, exactly. It's not celebrity driven, is it?
No, exactly. And I mean, that's and no disrespect to shows like that or My Dad Wrote a Porno or whatever. There are some massive shows out there. Indeed, even some of my own. But what's nice is the judges rewarded the ones that they just thought were the best. And, you know, the palpable excitement in the room of people feeling that they've been recognised and recognised by people who love podcasts, which is just subtly different to people who love radio, I think is a nice marker of an event.
You must have been very pleased when your professional partner, Helen Zaltzman, got the Podcast Champion Award.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I made a sort of sardonic remark about it on stage. But in reality, I think the reason she won the award was because not just doing Answer Me This with me and starting the show 11 years ago and doing The Allusionist, great show that that is, and being part of Radiotopia as the first British show and all of that. I think really the reason she won the award is because of the podcaster support group that she runs on Facebook, which she has done tirelessly for 5 or 6 years now. She does join in every thread in that community and advising loads of people how to start their shows. Real warmth and affection for that in the room. And, you know, Trevor, she was doing that before that technology existed, in fact. Back in 2007, when we started Answer Me This, she'd always answer every single email that came in of people asking stupid questions, people saying they were fans of the show, and people going through difficult personal moments in their lives even. I mean, I could just never be bothered. I just wanted to do the show. She's always had that kind of philanthropic element to what she's doing, and I think that's really why she, you know, connects with so many people, and I was really pleased to see her win for that.
Just one last thing. If you were talking to some students now and they said, Ollie, should I go into podcasting or broadcasting? What would you say?
I don't think it's either or, really. And I think now it's got to the stage where if you want to be a broadcaster of any sort in audio, if you don't do a podcast, it looks like you're not really trying. I mean, there's no excuse. It's a bit like wanting to be a video director and not having stuff on YouTube or, you know, wanting to be a journalist and not blogging. So I would just say, even if you think that your interests are purely radio as such, A, podcasting builds your skills anyway, but B, I think it's almost at the tipping point where if you're not a celebrity, radio bosses aren't going to be looking at you unless you can prove you build up an audience online, because everyone else that's applying for the same kind of opportunities has.
Ollie Mann, well done. Congratulations. Great show.
Thank you, Trevor. So excited to be on the show. Genuinely big fan.
Matt Hill is here. Can I talk to you, Matt?
Yeah, okay. If only you could say how well Ollie Mann did there. He was
Didn't he do brilliant?
Remarkable.
Yeah, amazing. So this is your second year, Matt, joint organiser at the British Podcast Awards. How was it for you?
Oh, it was an absolute dream, particularly like Cariad Lloyd's speech at the end there. I know we have a no speech policy, but I think when you let a comic improviser like Cariad onto the stage, she will always deliver the goods, and she was just wonderful. And it's such a remarkable show. And exactly what podcasting in this country has become, really, which is we do great interview shows, long form, in depth, in a way that you can't do on the radio. And I think Cariad really personifies that.
There's a lot of warmth in the room, to use that terrible cliche, that people who podcast genuinely love other people who make podcasts.
Yeah, and I think that's something that Helen Zaltzman came across with in her message to the room for picking up podcast champions. She just said that we should all help each other, and she was really clear about, even though there are some big brands and big celebrities getting into the game now, it's a really hot property in the way that it may not have been 2 or 3 years ago, we should still help each other out. Whether you're a big company or a bedroom producer, if someone needs a hand, we should do that. It's what fledgling medium like ours needs.
Congratulations, Matt. Well done. Lovely evening.
Thank you, Trevor.
Well, I found Miranda Sawyer from The Observer. You've taken off the high heels. You've gone back into the sneakers.
It's true.
But it's a comfortable environment, this, the podcast world, isn't it? Don't you think it's a bit more loving and supportive than the radio world?
It is. It's because it's a new medium. It reminds me a little bit of when stand-up comedy was young, you know? It's got that thing where everybody, they might bitch behind each other's backs, although, you know, who knows if they do, but, you know, they are supportive of each other because it's still a medium that's learning about itself, really, learning how far it can go, what's the best techniques. You know, it's only recently that there are ways and means of actually discovering just how, you know, exactly where your audience is, you know, getting that data back so that people can actually work out what they're doing, you know. So it is really a young medium, but it's exploding so much that I'm really happy that these awards are here.
You have to sit there every week and think of something to write about. Do you find yourself increasingly drawn to the podcast rather than the broadcast? I mean, I read your column and I sense that.
Yeah, definitely, because it's, you know, I've been writing about, well, we call it audio now, but it started off as radio for 12 years. That's quite a long time, and especially if you're writing about every week. If you're writing for the Observer reader, which I am, then there's only so much you can write about with radio, really, and it's essentially Radio 4. So in order to not always be writing, you know, whither the archers, should in our time change, then of course I started looking outwards, and I was really happy when podcasts came along, because actually I think that podcasts, because there's so many of them, there are always going to be some that will be suitable for the Observer reader, and actually the Observer reader tends to be somebody who is quite interested in innovation, wants to be kind of, and also is actually quite interested in learning things, and the quite a lot of podcasts have got a quite high level of kind of learning in there. So you can, you know, if you listen to, I know these are massive podcasts from America, but if you listen to 99% Invisible every week, you will learn something all the time. And I think a lot of podcasts are really good at that. They tell you stuff you don't know. Like, for example, the Tip Off one, that one, Best New Podcast. And that's a podcast about investigative journalism. So I don't really know anything about it. I know the results of investigative journalism. I read Private Eye, you know, those kind of things. It's really interesting to go through with a journalist what they did in order to get these results, and also how the story lands. They tell you this story landed and something happened. It changed everything. This story landed and it seemed like an equally interesting story and nothing really happened. And I find that immensely interesting.
Yeah, don't you think the New York Times Daily is also very good at that?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I love it. But also, it's interesting if you compare that with a radio show. So the New York Times Daily, it comes out every day, and it's a convenient length, it's not too long. And what it does is what a lot of podcasts do, it shows you a little bit of the workings of something. So it's presented by a bloke called Michael Barbaro, and he has got a fantastic audio presence. But what he does is he phones up people in the newsroom and he says, "Hi, it's Michael," and they go, "We can't talk now, I'll call you later." And they put that on the podcast because you have a sense then of this is journalism as it's happening. And you have an expert coming on and talking about whatever it is, a very minute thing that Trump has done, or something in Syria, or a case you've never heard about in Mexico. And it's amazing. I listen to it. I do listen to that every day.
I've just had an interesting experience. I just introduced Andrew Harrison from the Romaniacs to Chris Mason from BrexitCast. They'd never met. And I have to say, looking over
they're
my shoulder,
still talking because
they
just,
are. Yes,
I've just seen them do it.
But what I was saying to Chris was that I think his style as a presenter on radio has been influenced by his style as a presenter on a podcast, because it's just that little bit more. Is it relaxed? I don't know. Is it just a bit more interpretive?
Well, I think the problem with being working for the BBC, much as I love the BBC, is as soon as you work into a BBC building, you start being BBC. It happens to me, you know, I've made programmes in there. And you walk in there and you suddenly find yourself talking in Radio 4 voice. It's very nice. And you have to unlearn that. And, you know, if you're someone who's freelance, like I am, that's not hard because I live most of my life outside the BBC. But if you're in the BBC, you are trained. You know, you're trained to be an excellent radio journalist. And what podcasts, I think, teach BBC journalists is to kind of shrug a lot of that stuff off. Because it's about a very direct and intimate relationship with your audience. So you're not broadcasting at them, you're kind of telling them a story. It's a really different medium. And I think that, personally, it's helped quite a lot, actually, with a lot of presenters. There's some people that do it naturally. Eddie Mair is, you know, obviously he's an amazing presenter anyway, but, you know, if you listen to IPM, the stories on there are very beautifully podcastable. But that's because he's an amazingly versatile presenter who can switch from a hardcore political interview to something that's very sad within seconds. But not everybody can do that, and I think if people start making podcasts, they relax a little bit and then bring that back into their BBC work, and that's good.
Miranda, thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure.
The big winner tonight with three awards is Griefcast. Cariad makes it. And she's going to speak to me in a minute, but you're just texting your husband.
I'm just texting my husband to say I also won the best podcast of the year, which I didn't even know.
Well, that's not bad, is it?
I am so overwhelmed and very thankful. I didn't expect to win at all. So
now, on my podcast, several people have talked about how great Griefcast is.
Oh, that's lovely.
It clearly touches a chord.
Yes.
What was the original idea?
So my dad died when I was 15, and I have spent my life since then, the past 20 years, talking to people about death because I'm a very early member of the club. And so I've had a lot of time to process it and understand it. And then I just thought to myself, oh, I always have these really big chats with people about death. I wonder if other people would be interested. So I was pregnant. I recorded four, Adam Buxton, Sarah Pascoe were in those four. And I put them out just before I had my baby. And I got this overwhelming response immediately of, this is the conversation, I didn't know other people felt like this, I didn't know I was grieving, this I can relate to this. And I suddenly thought, oh, I wonder if everybody wants to talk about it, and they're just not.
Let me just stop you there and ask, how did people find it? Is it just because you had some profile anyway?
I think that it just certainly helped that I'm a comedian, and I was able to get in. So, for example, like, I can email Adam Buxton and say, hey, you know, I didn't know him very well, but I have friends who know him. Sarah Pascoe is my best friend. We went to university together. So I said, would you mind coming on and helping me figure out what this is? I think that helped. But then, honestly, it was just word of mouth. I have an editor who came on to the show about episode 12. Everything else I did myself. I had no producer, no studio. I just found somewhere, got a microphone and spoke to people, which is the incredible power of podcasts. You can do that. And if I'd waited to take it to a radio, I think it would have been a much longer process and I would have had to go through a lot more hoops. And I didn't have to do that, so I was able to maintain control of it. Which
now, how would you feel if Radio 4 or 5 Live or LBC or somebody came along and said, we'd like to broadcast your show, however, because we are now broadcasting it, you've lost editorial control?
Well, let's wait and see if they ask me. that's a question you need to think about when you're asked it. At the moment, I'm so happy to have editor. Like, my show is about an hour long. And I think with death and grief, you can't really rush it. You can't really go, anyway, then tell me how you felt and wrap it up neatly in 28
minutes. And here's the
travel. Exactly. And so it gives people a chance to talk about their lost loved ones and an hour to speak about them in a world where they often feel they're not allowed to talk about people that they love that have gone.
Well, it's a brilliant show and very worthy of its three awards. Congratulations.
I'm very, very grateful. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Phone calls, social media, SMS, email, codec control and visualization through the same interface. Phone box from Broadcast Bionics. Welcome to the social studio at bionics.co.uk.
It's the Radio Today programme, and this week marks the first anniversary of the atrocious terror attack on the Manchester Arena that left 22 people dead, hundreds more injured as well, when a bomb went off at the end of the Ariana Grande concert. And radio stations across Greater Manchester, across the UK, provided news updates, live reports as the tragedy began to unfold. BBC Radio Manchester and Radio Lancashire. Alan Beswick was on the air that night, and I'm pleased to say he's with us now.
I do.
Take us back to that night. What was the first inkling coming in that you had an idea something was up?
Well, there's two levels of inkling. The first inkling was people ringing the phone in and speaking to the production team and saying something's going on. The first caller that I heard was moments after it began, and that was a chap saying that he was waiting for his daughter and her friend at the arena, you know, waiting at the end of the concert, and it all gone off. There was chaos, and he couldn't find his child. He was still waiting for her to turn up, so that sort of thing. And then, of course, the frequency of calls and the content changed to... there was a loud explosion and some smoke, and then there was all the thoughts that it might have been some balloons going off as part of the close of the concert, as it were. Then somebody else was suggesting that it might have been a speaker that exploded. Now, how a speaker explodes, I really don't know, but that's what people were saying. And then we got the situation where some of the news channels, who have a slightly different take on what makes news, you know, they will broadcast something and then correct, but that's not the BBC way. The BBC requires a more authoritative decision. And so we were seeing and hearing on other news sites that it was a bomb, but it hadn't been confirmed. So we were still trying to, if you like, contain the thought that it might not be, there could be some other explanation. We weren't selling it, but do you know what I mean? We weren't saying it was a bomb. And we, just about the time I was talking to one caller, we then got the, I nearly said the okay, as if as if it was just a tap on the head and get on with it. But we then got the confirmation that it was a bomb, and it was okay to now say it was a bomb. But just seconds before that, I was engaged with a caller who'd already rung in before that message was relayed to us. And she said, "Alan, it is a bomb. I was in the foyer. I saw it explode, and there are body parts everywhere. And there's half a torso. There is a torso, half a body lying next to me." So you kind of can't keep up. Fortunately, we didn't have to try, but you can't keep up pretense after that. Once that has gone out, you know, it's there for all to hear.
You talked about, obviously, the calls coming into your production team, and you obviously not getting wind of that necessarily straight away because you were carrying on with your show. That presumably that's quite a small production team. What, you and a phone answerer and maybe a producer?
No, it's me, Talat, and Jason. So it's Talat, our producer, and Jason, who's our assistant producer. So, you know, one takes the calls and then the other one puts them through, you know. I mean, there isn't a lot of what you might call production, because we have a policy: if you ring, you get on. We're an open phone, and we don't have a subject or any of that. You know, you could be talking to Joe Bloke about his pet pig, and an hour later you could be talking to somebody, or even a minute later you could be talking about, you know, the situation in Syria. You know, it's that kind of phone. It's completely open.
Obviously, being a predominantly speech player show, I know you do play a couple of records early on in the programme, but...
Only if I'm fed up or I need a pee. You know, at my age, the bladder's not what it was.
But yeah, because it's predominantly speech, obviously it's hard to have that contact with your two producers that you've got there with you.
They're only a button away, you
yeah
know.
But obviously, if you're talking on the radio and you've got callers on at the same time, how much of a sense of the scale of it were you getting from them through the glass?
You get it all the time, because yes, I'm talking to callers all the time and listening, more importantly, because it's them that are gonna get us in trouble if anybody does. When you're doing a phone in, you're listening to the callers, but the production team can still communicate. They can speak to you in your cans. You know, we got split cans, so it's not a major issue. So we were fairly quickly aware that it was a major event. And then when the station managing editor arrived, you knew it was, because they don't get them out of bed easy. You know, oh, holy crap, management's here, you know. So you know then. And they're then involved in everything and getting the reporters out, most of whom were already out because they'd heard it. But equally, it was getting people out, organising what's going to happen the next morning, not in terms of the input to the programme. That's done by the production team for breakfast, but organising the extra manpower and all of that that would inevitably be required, and making decisions about what's going to happen on the output the following day. So, you know, management were here within half an hour. And so, you know, that there's the message. You don't need telling.
And yeah, you mentioned you were seeing, obviously, the pictures on the telly screens as well, and presumably social media video footage and pictures as well that were coming into Radio Manchester from people out there.
Yeah, well, I don't do social media, and I don't touch social media. It's the spawn of the devil. I have nothing to do with it, with a speech programme. But yes, we saw it on TV. You know, you're flicking through the news channels, and there are, you know, mobile phone footage and all that sort of citizen journalism on air. And then, of course, they got cameras there fairly quickly, and you can see, you know, when there's that many blue lights, you know it's for real.
Yeah, you mentioned the caller
one of those first callers that you had on telling you it was a bomb and she'd seen half a torso. What was your reaction to hearing that kind of level of detail, hearing it being quite gruesome?
Well, you don't have a reaction, do you? You're not. I nearly said you're not a human being. You're just a thing when you're sat in the middle of a maelstrom. Your job isn't to feel, your job is to happen. And so you don't think about it. You don't think, oh, that's horrid. And you don't think, oh, this is great radio. You don't think, oh, what can I do about it? You just, somebody wants to talk. And for me, the right answer was to let them. And you kind of had this, you have a responsibility to the audience, obviously, to not startle them. So part of what you're doing is taking the sting out of it to some extent, but leaving enough in for it to be real. And you're also protecting the caller, because whereas normally the caller, it's every person for themselves, as it were, in a late night phone-in. But on things like that, you're protecting the caller from their own experience, their own pain, and how not protecting them from crying and being upset and being hurt, because that's impossible, but protecting them from they are brandishing their soul to the world, and it's your job, my job, to protect them from the possible consequences of that, you know, audience wise but also them. They've got to live with themselves in the morning, and you have an obligation to do that. But in terms of your own thoughts, for me, I quite frankly didn't have any.
Presumably it hit you when you came off air, and I know you stayed on all night, didn't you?
Well, we stayed on till the team decided, I mean, they checked with me, because obviously I'm the one that's got to sit here, and they said, can you stay on till 2, because we're normally on till 1. And I said, yes, of course. And then it was patently obvious that there were hundreds of people wanting to talk. They don't all get on. That's the nature of the life. So would we stay on till breakfast can come in at 5? Of course we will. So you just stay on all night. But at the risk of sounding like a monster, when it's over, it's over. You go home, you have a cup of coffee, you go to bed. It's just a job. You're just at work. You know, don't think of us who just sit on our bottoms in an air-conditioned studio talking. Think of the people who were involved. They felt it. Think of the people who've got to pick up the bits. And when I say bits, I mean like half a torso. Think of those. They're the people, the firefighters. Well, they had a rough night in many ways. But the ambulance service, the police, all those other people, the bomb disposal squad. Think of a guy in a bomb disposal squad Land Rover flying over the Pennines as fast as he can so that he can get there to say there are no more bombs, or to make the place safe, knowing that he may well blow himself to bits in the process. Think of them. They've got problems. We just talk and listen.
I suppose it's an enabling function as well, though, for a local radio station like Radio Manchester. People were tuning in to find out what was going on. You would have had parents and grandparents of kids who were at the gig listening, and they were wanting the information. They were listening to the eyewitness report. So you've got to be mindful of that, I guess, the whole time.
Well, you're always mindful of that. Broadcasters have a perpetual responsibility. The responsibility doesn't change in extremis. We're always aware that what is going out on our output, whether it's a Rolling Stones record or a little fat ginger presenter talking rubbish, we're always aware that there's fallout for that for somebody at the other end. So you have to be aware of that. But no more so. It's just more dramatic, but no more so just because it's in extremis. This is why we exist, for crying out loud.
I know you've been doing this for more than 30 years now, Alan. Was this the biggest kind of breaking news story you've dealt with that's happened while your show has been on the air?
I'm not sure. I remember I was on in the mornings when Dunblane broke out, and I remember that specifically because I'm quite mouthy, as you may have gathered already, but the week before, I was just doing the morning programme, and the week before, yet another lunatic had gone into a school with a machine gun in America and wiped out half the teachers and kids, and I did my usual rant that what is it about Americans? You meet them as ordinary individuals and they're fine, but as a collective, they are an abomination on the bum of earth. you know. And then a week later, I'm just sat there and the news is scrolling past my eyes and I'm doing something apropos of nothing. And it went past, there's been a shooting at a school in Dunblane. So like a, you know, like a man who's interested in BBC balance said, it's not just the Yanks. There's been a shooting at a school in Dunblane, expecting it to be some disgruntled kid firing air pellets at the windows. And it turned into the story that we know is Dunblane. So that was quite a drama story. But, you know, these 180 degree stories, you know, what's the most important one? None of them are. If you put more importance in something as extreme as that than you do in the run of the mill broadcasting, then you're doing something wrong, because every story should be the most important thing you're doing at that moment.
And you mentioned your any topic policy that you have on your show. Presumably over the last 12 months since this, you've had people on the phone talking about it. There's been various stages in the investigation, obviously, to create news talking points. But for a station like Radio Manchester, this has dominated the agenda over the last year.
Well, it has, but it doesn't dominate a coffee shop. I mean, ludicrously and rightly, life goes on. You know, people realise it, and we had weeks of it being... I mean, we opened the programme an hour earlier the night after just to give the audience that wanted to time to take a breath and with a little more consideration than the abreaction of the night before to explain their point of view and their emotion at that. And, of course, the following night and for the next couple of weeks it was dominated, but then it drifted away. I mean, the people that were involved, the emergency services, the individuals, the grandmas, the grandsons and all the rest of it, they'll remember it for the rest of their lives. It will be a major thing in the rest of their lives if they're fortunate enough to have one, and for the bereaved, the same thing. But for Joe Bloke, it quickly isn't the story of the day. You know, a fortnight later, it wasn't leading the papers. So the talk of the washhouse, which is what we do, the talk of the washhouse isn't, oh, there's been this tragedy, this is our life now. This is Manchester. It's bigger than the bomb. 22 people died, which is horrendous. Hundreds of people were injured, which is horrendous. But this is Manchester. We've had the IRA bombed us three times. We had the M6 bombing of soldiers and families going back to Catterick on the coach in the dead of night. We've had the Peterloo massacre, if you want to go back a long way. We've had all that went on in Rochdale. We've had the Shipman trial, Munich 58, the Blitz. This is just another one. And it's horrible. I don't want to diminish the significance of it, but life goes on.
And do you think you would do anything different faced with a similar situation in the future?
I hope not. I hope we would do it with the same responsibility. We wouldn't get the same event. We wouldn't get the same result. But I hope we would do it with the same sense of the importance of the people who are involved. I mean, we're just a tube. We're just a conduit. And our job in that kind of programme, on that kind of occasion, is to not get in the way. You know, it's like, you know, the great advocacy of acting. You know, get on, do your lines and don't bump into the furniture. Well, that's our job. Don't bump into the story. Let it happen. So I hope we will do it in the same ambience. But clearly it won't be the same way.
I know you had some recognition at the Gillard Awards, and obviously you would probably say, you know, you're doing the best show you can every single night, so it's not that you put anything extra into that show, but...
Awards are like piles. Awards are like piles. Sooner or later, every bum gets one.
But the hard work that went in and the team effort, I suppose it's nice to get the recognition for that and the long night.
For those that think that awards are significant, then yes. I mean, I'm not a pot collector, but for those, and I'm not diminishing those that are, but yes, I mean, the industry recognises us. But on the same night, they recognised BBC Radio London for all the work they did on Grenfell. Now, was Grenfell worse than ours? Of course it wasn't. Was it as bad? They were the same. People lost their lives unnecessarily. But you have to remember that there was a great song years and years ago during the Vietnam War written by Ewan McCall, a good Salford lad, and it was called Grey October. And it was all about the comparison between the morning of the deaths in Aberfan and the ignorance of the deaths and the devil may care of the deaths being perpetrated by our allies, the Americans, in Vietnam. So hundreds of kids were getting blown up in Vietnam and nobody gave a stuff. And kids died, 100 kids died in Abafan, and the world stood still. So, you know, it's extraordinary, but 150,000 people die every single day. Every single day.
Just finally, I suppose it's nights like these that show the importance of local radio and BBC local radio in particular, isn't it? It's where people turn to, people put it on.
In terms of demonstrating to those who have to pay a licence fee and those that create the legislation and the regulation that requires them to, it demonstrates to them that if we had to make a profit doing what we were doing, we would fail probably and would cease to exist. And this demonstrates a reason for public broadcasting, the world all over, but in our case, the BBC.
That's Alan Bezick from BBC Radio Manchester and Radio Lancashire talking to me about this week's anniversary of the Manchester Arena terror attack. David Lloyd's Radio Moments are on the way after this.
At james.crid.land on the Radio Today podcast and in your favourite podcast app, I'm James Cridland, the radio futurologist. This week, measuring radio's best customers. Whenever I speak to companies or students about how we consume linear radio, it comes as a big surprise to them that internet radio is so small. Three pieces of research came out last week highlighting this. In the UK, Rajar knocked on nearly 25,000 doors and asked people living behind them a bunch of questions about their radio listening. That gets the quarterly radio ratings for the country, but also gets them platform data. And radio delivered over the internet, both websites and apps, accounts for 9.3% of all radio listening. Just 9.3%. In the US, Edison Research went through some similarly rigorous question asking of 1,277 people in the US, recruited both online and offline, and they too discovered that internet radio listening of AM/FM signals is just 8%. Broadcast, it seems, accounts for the vast majority of radio listening, and that's backed up by recent research from other companies in Australia, Norway, and other places. And then I discovered Jacob Media's tech survey, and that appeared to claim that 27% of all radio listening happened over the internet, and this figure was so high, three times as large as other data, well, I had to ask some questions. So, unlike Rajar or Edison Research's data, Tech Survey isn't a survey that attempts to reflect what the US is doing as a whole. For a start, the data also includes people in Canada. 9% of the total survey results, incidentally. But rather more importantly, the online-only survey is filled in by listeners following a link from radio station websites or their VIP newsletters. So Tech Survey is, therefore, an online-only survey of what I'd term radio superfans. They don't just listen to the radio, they love it so much that they visit the radio station websites and are probably signed up to the radio station's VIP email club. If you're looking for any evidence of people falling out of love with the radio, you're not going to find it here, because by definition, anyone who's done this survey thinks that radio is the super best thing ever. And this doesn't make Tech Survey useless. In fact, once you're aware of what it's actually measuring, it's really useful, because it's a survey of our best customers. The survey says that your best listeners want your radio station available on the device they use. So if they have an Amazon Alexa, they want you there. And if they have a Google Home, they want you there too. And if they have a Comcast cable box, they'd quite like your station to appear there as well. And I can relate to this because of the two stations I listen to most. I listen during a typical week on a DAB radio, a Google Home speaker, a different DAB radio, a streaming app, the DAB radio in the car, and via their website. And the other radio stations probably only get listened to on one device. Now, as I'm at pains to point out, I'm not normal. But there's an element of common sense here, I think, irrespective of any survey. All this, therefore, seems to point to a distribution strategy for your superfans that's as simple as, if it has a speaker, get your radio station there because your audience expects you to be there anyway. Not only is radio's future a multi-platform one, but multi-platform is especially important to your superfans. What will they do if they can't find your radio station on a device? Well, I'll tell you, they'll listen to someone else. Or if you like it better phrased this way, they'll check out your competition. So overall, this is a good reminder that perhaps a focus on our superfans might be a good thing to have every now and again. And this has also reminded me that boring methodology slide that you skip through at the beginning of survey decks, well, that's probably the most important slide of all. You can get my weekly newsletter at james.crid.land and daily podcast news at podnews.net. And until next time, keep listening.
David Lloyd Radio Moments.
As Simon Mayo changes the shape of his Radio 2 Drive Time show, let's remember it's now 30 years since he moved to the Radio 1 Breakfast Show.
Climb your Fisher, and this is me. It's taken me 5 weeks to get used to waking up early. That's what I've been doing all this time. 7:08. You may well have read that there is going to be a team looking after you, getting you up for breakfast every morning. I'll introduce you to the various members of the team as they crop up. The first one is here. Her name is Carol Dooley. Good morning.
Good morning.
Taking care of the travel and weather. Where do you come from?
That's right. I come from the Emerald Isle. Kilkenny, actually.
And your life history in 10 seconds.
My life history in 10 seconds, I think I'll do it in 5. Kilkenny, Dublin, Liverpool, here.
And that will do nicely. Yes, the other member of the team you will have heard of already, his name is Rod McKenzie. We'll be talking to him in just a second because on the new breakfast show we have news headlines every 20 minutes for you. Thank you for
coming. Just about everybody's tried 2020 news, haven't they? Sounds great on paper. Real pig when you're trying to work around it. In the early 80s, UK commercial radio was still very heavily regulated and stations were required to carry all manner of novel programmes. It was an industry ripe for disruption, and that came this week in 1984 in the form of a fresh new pirate station from the North Sea.
Broadcasting from international waters, this is All Europe Radio Laser 558. It is 3 p.m. in the UK, 4 o'clock in Central Europe. In today's news, police have discovered a huge stock of terrorist explosives and ammunition in Northern Ireland. Security forces around Carrickmore and County Tyrone found 4 munitions dumps containing 2 tons of explosives.
All hit radio Laser 558 and Quincy Jones with Razzmatazz from The Dude. Jesse Brandon checking out for this evening, making way for Steve Masters. I'll be back at 3 p.m. UK time, 4 continental tomorrow afternoon. Meantime, thanks for the birthday reception. I'm sorry, that wasn't funny, but I promise I'll try harder tomorrow. Take care and stay with the Laser. Human League here, the Lebanon, at Laser 558, where the music is never more than a minute away.
Every single British music jock suddenly wanted to sound like the great Jesse Brandon. That was from the first day on air from Laser 558 this week, 34 years ago. The station only lasted a year, but attracted real audiences and had a real impact on British music radio back then. Let's compare now that hot sound with the sound of early official commercial radio. Here's a little Plymouth sound for you. It launched this week in 1975.
Oh, yay! Oh, yay! Oh, yay! Buy, sell, or exchange your wares on Plymouth Sound Tradio.
Hello, Wilf?
Yeah, my darling, I'm sorry, because our electricity is off, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. Now, I was hoping to contact you. I've been trying for quite some time. The electricity is off, and I was hoping, I don't know what your program is this afternoon. I'm home, and I'm an officer in the naval base.
Yes. Well, Wilf is gone anyway.
Oh,
there you are, back again. Well, Wilf, you should really have got on this morning on the phone forum, love.
Well, my darling, the electricity has gone off.
We yes. Can't,
I cannot hear you on my set.
Yes.
And what I'm going about, I hope you will bring up about these power cuts. I'd like to have something, but I'd like to put the blinking blokes up against the wall and bloody well, excuse my language.
Yeah. Well, Wilf, we can't continue now with this conversation because this, as you know, is the magazine programme and we don't get into controversy on Mix with Louise. If you've missed Phone Forum, unfortunately, today, but I hope you'll get on the line tomorrow to David Bassett on Phone Forum and put your views and opinions across. Will you, Wilf?
We can hear you, my love, because electricity is off.
No, but you can get on the phone like you have to me now, can't you?
Okay,
and meanwhile, if you're having a problem with the electricity, which I'm sure you are,
yeah,
and if you want any help, then of course call 27272. And if Jackie has any information, she'll give it to you there.
Well, Thursday I'll be free. I'll phone up David then.
All right, Will.
We should put these buggers up against the
yes,
wall.
Well, Will, I must ask you to stop this conversation now.
Okay, my love.
Now, who is next, please, Chris? Tina, go ahead.
Hello. I have evening wear for sale.
Yes, my love.
Size 16.
I don't know about you, I could listen to that all day, and back then we did. Plymouth Sound, which launched this week in 1975 as we headed for that warm summer. And that same week, Beacon Radio, which was being planned for Wolverhampton, was struggling to get enough money to go on air. It told the regulator, then the IBA, that it would resolve its investment challenges. Commercial radio spluttered as it came into existence inch by inch, and Mercia Sound in Coventry was the first station in the second chapter. It began this week in 1980.
Pretty slinky and appropriate, eh? Finding a record called Radio to play on the radio. Mercia Sound is the radio station to which you are listening. A group called Dolly Dots and a presenter called Dave Jameson has picked that as his hit pick. After the 9.30 news, you'll be able to hear Dave Jameson's show. It's in Scottish, so we hope you've got your teacher's notes. If you've just joined us, hello, 12 minutes after 7 o'clock, 7.12. We're going to pay the rent and then we'll have Jimmy Ruffin.
Mercia. We had to submit our initial programme schedule to the IBA, and I sent ours down, and then I was summoned down to the IBA to see the head of programming or whatever it was at the IBA. He'd got the programme schedule and he'd gone through it and he said, what we'd like to see is an hour of classical music programming every lunchtime. And I said, we're not doing that. And he said, well, I'm not going to approve the programme schedule unless you do an hour of classical music programming every lunchtime. And I said, we'll do some classical music programme, but I'm not doing an hour of it every day. And he said, well, I won't approve the programme schedule then.
Ian Rufus, the first programme controller of Mercia Sound. Ian died 2 years ago this week, and the station arrived on the scene 38 years ago this week. It's now part of the Free Radio brand. Free Radio. 3 years ago this week, a departure from Radio 1.
Well, Fern, have a great last show. It's going to not be the same not seeing you every single day, but enjoy your last show today, and we love you, and we're going to miss you.
Oh, thank you. Love you. Don't make me cry again, for God's sake. I'm drained already, and it's 5 past 10.
I'm going to make you cry this weekend, though, when I see you face to face.
I'll cry at you being Travie McCoy, that's for
sure. I'm going to hold your elbows and look you right in the eyeballs and really make you cry. But good luck with everything. Good luck with baby number two.
Oh, thank you, darling. Love you.
Love you, Fernie. See you in Norwich.
Bye.
The end of Fern Cotton on Radio 1 after almost 10 years, that was this week in 2015. 1940 now, and there's a new name on air at the BBC, but his first show is in the most difficult of times.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom.
Winston Churchill's first broadcast as Prime Minister this week in 1940, back in the days of Reith's BBC. John Reith used to be invited to the War Cabinet meetings, but he called them farcical affairs, and he referred to Churchill as a horrid fellow.
Unless we conquer, and conquer we must. As conquer we shall.
So with Star FM launching in Slough 25 years ago, later called Time but now closed,
I'm Peter Dixon.
The death of Britain's first DJ, Christopher Stone, 53 years ago.
Now I'm going to put on another of Sanderson's ballads.
The first utterly drunk presenter, 81 years ago, Lieutenant Commander Thomas Woodruff.
At the present moment, the whole fleet is lit up. When I say lit up, I mean lit up by fairy lamps.
And Lochbroom FM launching for Northwest Scotland from an old tin roof building with no toilet but great views 21 years ago. Thank goodness for the Argyle Hotel just down the road. Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Thanks to David, James, Trevor, Roy, guests this week Alan Bezick, Ford Ennals and everyone at the British Podcast Awards. Next week, I'm on my own. No Roy, no David Lloyd, they're all on holiday. Tune in to find out whether we can make a show out of nothing. I'll see you then.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.